Good evening. I stand here with a great degree of trepidation, even fear, because I have heard, I think I know, how tremendously explosive these issues are, how emotionally laden, and I also think I know that religion very often is perceived by people of homosexual orientation as causing great anguish and pain, suffering and injustice. And I pray to God that I don't hurt anyone or offend anyone in what I say. On the other hand, I also pray to God that I do justice to my beliefs and my tradition, and that I speak for what I believe is good and necessary for American civilization. So I want to begin by saying something that may be a revelation to many people in the room, which is that the recognition and the acceptance of homosexuality and homosexual tendencies is not new. It's not something that's been in the closet for thousands of years and is only now awakening. Only now being acknowledged. It's not merely a new awakening of respect for individual differences and life choices as part of our modern movement towards the flourishing of the autonomous individual. Homosexuality in the mainstream of human culture is old. Most ancient societies, perhaps I'd be careful and say many ancient societies, hardly differentiated between homosexual behavior and heterosexual behavior. The gender of the partner in many ancient societies made very little difference to society. One of the most important books on the subject claims that if you had sex with a man or a woman was as interesting as what you had for breakfast. Which means, or I'll elaborate, that unbridled and unrestricted sexual expression in all forms and types was ubiquitous in many ancient cultures. Men had sex with women and had sex with men, with little girls and young boys, with a single partner and in large groups, with total strangers, and with a variety of domesticated animals. Undisciplined sex dominated man's life and the lives of society. Throughout the ancient world and up to the recent past, in many parts of this universe, sexuality infused virtually all of society, and as far as I understand, that was to the great detriment of society. In a number of pre-modern cultures, whether ancient or Greece or medieval France and many others, male-male sexuality, and some of you might remember this from Plato, male-male sexuality was considered to be loftier and more respectable than heterosexual relations. And then, approximately only 3,000 years ago, came the Hebrew Bible and proclaimed that God has a plan to uplift humanity, and that plan includes unprecedented restrictions on sexuality. That was new. Sexual expression is not, says the Bible, not to be squelched, but it is to be limited and circumscribed. No sex out of marriage. No sex with animals. No sex between men and men. These prohibitions, many of you might know, are found in Leviticus chapter 18 and chapter 20 of the Hebrew Bible. And the context there, and Imam Zia mentioned this, the context is absolutely clear. These abominations were practiced by the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Canaanites who surrounded the ancient Israelites. And the Bible says, don't copy their practices. Despite the fact that everyone does it and everyone did it, and despite the fact that you have a real strong urge to do it, don't do it. Rather, as the very beginning of the book of Genesis says, men are to marry women. The biblical ideal, we also heard this earlier tonight, is for one man to marry one woman. They are to cleave to each other. That's the language of the beginning of Genesis. They are to endeavor to spend their life together and to build a cohesive family. Sex in Judaism was sanctified. In Hebrew, sanctify, l'kadesh, means to separate. sex was separated from the world and placed in the bedroom, in the home, in the bed of husband and wife, in private. Why? Not because limiting sex to heterosexual marriage is necessarily natural. No, it's not natural. Sex with everyone, everything, is more natural. Human history teaches us that limiting sex to a man and a wife is not the only natural way to do it. The Bible limits sex not because it's natural, but rather because God has a blueprint for civilizing and uplifting mankind, and that blueprint, that plan, runs through the limitation of our sexual desires, and especially our sexual activities. And as far as I see it, there are, let's say, two levels to this civilizing practice, process. One, sexuality in general must be controlled and disciplined. Natural instincts must be rechanneled, and man must learn and internalize delayed gratification. This is part of the moral maturation of man, especially male, that allows him, man, to efficiently direct his energy towards the improvement of society. But the second level of this civilizing process is that the male and the female complement each other. There is a certain fundamental moral personality evolution. I should say that again. A certain fundamental moral personality evolution that usually only occurs when one from Venus and one from Mars spend their life together and dedicate their lives to each other. And this is especially true for the male. Men are refined, and men are brought to moral maturity through the commitment to the continuous companionship of the female. And it's eminently possible, as many have said, that it was the institution of male-female marriage brought to us by the Hebrew Bible as the exclusive way to express sexuality. It was that wedding of man and wife that enabled Western civilization to grow and to flourish. When sexual energy was not placed within the boundaries of male-female marriage, societal development was usually stymied. The gradual emergence of Western civilization has been arduous development, and that's an accomplishment. Western civilization, it's an accomplishment that we dare not take lightly. I'm going to end this first section of my talk by quoting from Dennis Prager. And he writes the following: accepting homosexuality as the social, moral, or religious equivalent of heterosexuality would constitute a modern assault on the extremely hard-won, millennia-old battle for a family-based, sexually monogamous society. While it's labeled as progress, Dennis Prager writes that the acceptance of homosexuality would not be new at all, and it would not be progress. It would be a reversion to the way things were in so many societies 3,000 years ago. Second part of my presentation. So you heard me say just now that traditional Judaism is unequivocally against homosexuality. We hold it's wrong and ultimately poses a threat not only to Jewish values, but to American civilization. But, now it's going to sound like I'm going to say the opposite. That's the way it is with us Jews. Despite everything I say, homosexuality is not the greatest sin or the most pernicious threat that we have to combat. It's not. The more morally significant threatening aspect of postmodern American culture is the primacy placed on self-fulfillment, especially within the realm of sexuality. The dictates and the mores of Jewish law and values frequently clash with the current American ethical mindset, which promotes exercising personal autonomy towards achieving self-fulfillment. Within the highly eroticized Western culture, the greatest manifestations of this mentality are not homosexuality, but pornography, heterosexual promiscuity, sky-high divorce rates, and startling amounts of adultery. That's where we should be. I'm talking in the name of organized religion. That's where we should be picking our fights and fighting our battles. Why do I say that? Because few people are drawn without innate tendencies to homosexuality. But lots of people are drawn to adultery, and lots of people are drawn to pornography. It's much more natural, it's much more prevalent for human beings, and I mean men in our society, to be drawn to promiscuity and to divorce and to adultery and to pornography than they're drawn to homosexuality. The fight we should be fighting and the activities we should be condemning are much more all of those matters I just mentioned. Homosexuality can deal with itself. Most of us, without those inborn tendencies, are not going to be drawn to homosexuality. I'm making this a sin, but we have greater sins, I think, in our culture to fight. Which means that I'm trying to say that homosexuality should not be the ground zero of religion's effort to uplift and sanctify sexuality and the family in this society. There are more prevalent and fundamental issues to deal with. Homosexuality ought not to be the convenient scapegoat upon whom religious people blame all of America's ills. That's part two. Part three. So what does the rabbi say when a person who is homosexual comes to him for pastoral counseling? What does the rabbi say? The first thing that the rabbi says to himself is empathy. And the second thing is empathy, and the third thing is empathy. People becoming aware of homosexual tendencies and who are struggling with them are very often extremely vulnerable and difficult places. Their pain and their frustration, their anguish is beyond what most of us can probably imagine. And an effort must be made to understand them and to accept them for what they are and what they are experiencing. So I would say that while we rabbis should never give the impression that homosexuality is permitted, we also have to make it clear that homosexual tendencies and inclinations and thoughts are not prohibited and not sinful. It's the act that's problematic. It's not the desire. The desire is actually pretty natural and not regulated and not forbidden. Judaism doesn't claim to regulate thoughts. It claims to control, to want to control behavior. So what about behavior, homosexual behavior? What does the rabbi say? Well, the first thing the rabbi says is that homosexual behavior is governed, and Imam Zia mentioned this as well, is governed by the same free will choices as are all other sexual behaviors. The challenge and the temptations are enormous, but the divine imperative is to use all your energy and all your power to resist. The person must be constantly supported, says the rabbi to the rabbi. You must constantly support those homosexuals in their daily effort to resist actualizing their inclinations. In many cases, despite the best of efforts, there are going to be moments of weakness, leading to failure to live up to the divine imperative. But to fail is to human. It's to be human. The person is not to be excoriated for those failures. I myself have failed many times in sexual matters, and the homosexual sins are no worse than mine. You have to repent, you have to try again, you have to try harder, and go on. But there may be cases in which the urge is so strong that failure comes often. There may be cases in which the effort to resist and the sense of failure when unsuccessful are just too much. Or there may be cases in which the loneliness of celibacy is experienced as impossible to tolerate any longer. And all of these cases may be ones in which the person's sanity and physical well-being are very, very much at stake. So what does the rabbi say? Well, there may be cases in which the rabbi may counsel that a discreet, monogamous, homosexual relationship ought to be pursued. Not because it's permitted, it's forbidden. But it still may be counseled as the lesser of many evils. From the perspective of Jewish law, we might have a case in which danger to life overrides the other commandments. If the homosexual urges are killing the person's efforts to resist. Or we might have cases of duress causing the forbidden act not to be culpable and not to carry with it any sanction. And through it all, we counsel homosexuals that there are 613 commandments in the Torah. As Rabbi Shmuley Boteach has said a number of times, if you have a problem with two of the commandments, one, the prohibition against gay sex, and number two, the dictate upon a man and a woman to marry and have kids, well, there are still 611 left. That should keep you busy. In other words, what I'm trying to say is the following. The failure to keep two of the commandments doesn't exempt you from all the others. It doesn't make you morally tainted so that your fulfillment of the other good deeds in Judaism loses all its value. The good deeds, the commandments that a homosexual fulfills, the value of those good deeds is no less than the value of my good deeds. We all do the best we can in the life circumstances that we have. That's the end of the third part of my presentation. The fourth part. How do we, not rabbis, how do we as Jews, Christians, Muslims, how do I think we should relate to homosexuals and homosexuality? Well, I'm going to divide that in a number of different levels. How do you relate to someone that you think has homosexual inclinations? My answer, relate to them like you relate to me. That person lives with urges to do something that is forbidden. So do I. I'm a married man. And I live with a woman for the past 30 years, my wife. But I have an attraction to women other than my wife. Homosexuals have attractions to people they shouldn't. Like I said, so do I. It's easier for me to live with my attractions and to overcome them because I have a wife waiting at home. The homosexual doesn't have any outlet. So cut him some slack. What if you suspect that this person has actually succumbed to the irresistible power of his inner passions? How should you relate to him? Relate to him like you relate to me. Because I also have sexual urges that I have failed in. If you can accept me, accept him. But be easier on him, because it's harder for him. And what if you know for certain that the person lives a gay lifestyle pretty consistently? How do you relate to him? Or her? Well, I'll tell you, from a Jewish perspective, if our Jewish communities usually welcome Jews who violate the Sabbath, or who eat pork, which is forbidden in our religion, or people who don't hide the fact that they regularly cheat on their income tax, and we still accept them to our communities and our synagogues, well, then welcome active homosexuals as well. They're no worse. Perhaps better. Their inclinations and their desires are even harder to overcome. We should welcome them into our families, into our homes, into our synagogues, into our communities. Welcome them and their adopted children. Homophobia is wrong. And shunning gays is wrong. We must not, in my opinion, we must not accept or legitimize the sin, but we must recognize reality and both feel and display utmost empathy and sensitivity. And I pray to God that I can live that. The last part of my presentation. Public policy. Obviously, we can spend hours on it. I'm about to. No, I'm not. So, the first thing I have to say when talking about public policy is that politics makes for strange bedfellows. We must carefully distinguish between religious philosophy, on the one hand, religious philosophy and standards, and on the other hand, public policy. It sounds like on this matter, I disagree with Imam Zia. All things being equal, maximum civil freedom is the best thing for maximum human flourishing. Not all values and not all standards should be regulated by the government, and certainly not enforced. Many things are best left in the hands of the individual and his moral conscience, and in the hands of religious and social organizations. I believe that everything possible should be done for the good of gays as individuals, while not doing anything that would promote social acceptance of homosexuality and same-sex marriage as an institution. Now, there are a variety of ways in which we can work out the practicalities of this very nuanced approach. I'll give you some examples. Discrimination against gays in the workplace should be eliminated. Perhaps there's even room for domestic partner benefits and perhaps even for gay civil unions, but in my opinion, not for gay marriage, qua marriage. And I want to end by quoting again from Dennis Prager, who said as follows, "By and large, it is society, not the individual, that chooses whether homosexuality will be widely practiced. A society's values, much more than individual tendencies, determine the extent of homosexuality in that society. Thus, we can have great sympathy for the exclusively homosexual individual while strongly opposing social acceptance of homosexuality. In this way, we retain both our hearts and our values." Thank you.